Good morning, guys. Welcome to the Managing IP Masterclass on Trade Secrets. My name is Charlotte Kilpatrick. I am a journalist here with Managing IP, and I'm very excited to introduce my guests today. The first one I have is Tilman Brettenstein. He's the lead IP counsel for BASF. Then I am joined by Donald O'Connell, Managing Director at Shorten Innovation Services, and Martin Yeagy, IP Manager at First Light Fusion. So Tilman, can you tell us just very briefly a little bit about yourself and how you came to Trade Secrets?
Thanks, Charlotte. Yes, absolutely. I find Trade Secrets personally very interesting. They complement what I've been learning over the last couple of years as a patent attorney, and they fit in nicely. And so I've been running a Trade Secrets program at my last company and also doing that at the current one.
Cool. And Donald, how about you?
Well, my company is very active in Trade Secrets. We do a lot of education. We have a lot of audit tools, and we also have a product in the market that allows you to classify your trade secrets. So we're finding that it's a really interesting form of IP.
Okay. And Martin, how about you?
Well, as the IP manager here at First Light, I'm responsible for all aspects of IP, but in particular for trade secrets, then I put into place the policy and all the processes that go around it for the company here.
Can you just, Martin, tell us what is First Light Fusion? I think people are probably familiar with BASF, but what is First Light Fusion?
Yeah, First Light Fusion is an Oxford University spin-out. So we're, although we've just actually gone past 10 years in existence, it's still, we're like a university spin out, small company, just over 50 people now. And we're looking to solve fusion power generation using the simplest machine possible, which is actually a pretty tricky problem to solve anyway.
Yeah, that I'm trying to even imagine what that would look like. And I'm getting some old 90s movie in my head coming up with Jennifer Q, but that's cool. Good luck with that. That's very important. All right, so we're going to go straight into the first question. We can talk about trade secrets all day, but if it's not actually an issue, then we can all just go home and enjoy our Tuesday. But is trade secret theft on the rise? So Donald, I'll go to you with that one. What's going on right now?
Yes, the number of trade secret instances is definitely increasing. There's data from a number of sources. It's mainly US data, so we definitely see more litigation in the US. But even in the US, many cases don't involve US companies, so you see US versus foreign companies. And we're also seeing evidence of trade secret cases increasing elsewhere. So there is evidence to suggest this is becoming more and more of an issue, either from employees, competitors, cyber criminals, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Have you guys come across any big cases, Martin or Tilman, in your various parts of the world?
I think there have been a few big name cases. And as Donald said, they're mostly in the US. I'm not sure that I completely agree with Donald, though. I mean, certainly I agree that there's more cases have hit the news, even mainstream media. But I'm not sure that necessarily means that there's more theft, because I suspect most of the theft goes unreported and unlitigated. So I don't know there's any real statistics on that. But certainly I agree that it's bigger news. There are more court cases. And I also imagine that there are more international ones following the same trend of more international trade.
Right. So here's the golden question for you folks who are in-house. How should you decide if something should be a trade secret? Tilman, you're in-house. I'll start with you. What advice would you give?
Yeah, first of all, in my opinion, it must be worth it. Trade secrets don't cost you no official fees or annuities, but they don't come for free either. They need effort to protect them, or as the Trade Secret Directive says, reasonable measures to keep secrets. So you really got to do something about that. That doesn't come for free. So first you look, is there any competitive advantage that will justify any effort you're doing? Well, if it has value, you could not patent it in the first place. So all the business type secrets, maybe on the software side, you cannot patent them anyway. If you could, so you're deciding between trade secret and patent, then it's kind of a very logical flow, I think. How high is the risk that you would lose them, that somebody else would develop them, and maybe come up with IP that blocks you? And you weigh that against the risk associated with patenting, which is mainly the disclosure of your secret.
Okay. And Martin, what about you? Anything you would add?
I think Tilman made some good points there, and certainly do have to consider the cost of trade secrets, that they're not free, you know. You still have to make reasonable efforts. I would say the one thing you shouldn't forget is negative results. So, for example, where you have made some experiments or tried to make a new product and it hasn't worked, and that is also of value, because it could have cost thousands of pounds to make that product and find that it didn't work, or run that experiment and find that it didn't work. So that would be valuable information for a competitor. They know that they don't have to do that. So never forget negative results as well.
Oh, that is interesting. Okay. So Donald, how should you determine if something should be a trade secret or regular IP? Is there anything you would like to add when you're looking at something? Or like a mental checklist?
No, I think that the comments that have been made already are very valuable. I very much like Martin's comments about the negative information that people, obviously, a patent, you can't apply for a patent if your invention doesn't work, but people don't realize that a trade secret can be negative in nature, and negative information can be extremely valuable. But I think it's back to the definition. As long as you have information that is confidential, valuable, and you can take reasonable steps to protect it, then it should at least be considered as to whether it is worth the effort of keeping something a trade secret. But obviously not every piece of confidential information warrants being treated as a trade secret, so you have to be somewhat choosy.
Okay. So what are the challenges of keeping a trade secret? I've been to several conferences where people have talked of, like, you know, the Men in Black stick, where you just, like, erase someone's memory, which we obviously don't have. So what makes this difficult? Donald, let's start with you.
Well, I think there's a number of factors. First of all, the human nature. People aren't always good at keeping secrets.
Okay.
Secondly, the digital nature of the world. It's very easy to do copy and paste, and people can share stuff much more easily these days. And of course, lots of trade secrets are digital in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, companies are embracing collaborative or open forms of innovation or outsourcing. So what companies don't sometimes realize is that a significant percentage of their trade secrets are being shared with others. So not only have you got to keep it secret, but the other parties also got to keep it secret. And then, of course, cyber criminals, if they're after IP, are only after your trade secrets. No cyber criminal will break into your company to steal your patents or your trademarks. That information is public, whereas you have to break in to steal your trade secrets. So it's a number of things: human nature, digital, the collaborative innovation nature of life these days, and the baddies out there, the hackers and the cyber criminals.
So, Tilman, Martin said that his company's only 50 people. For you, Tilman, how many people are you talking about in your company that you need to keep under wraps for a trade secret?
Slightly more. I think we're currently at 140,000.
Oh, okay.
So rather a large company, which obviously has many interfaces. And I like what Donald just mentioned about the human aspect in all of that. I think earlier we talked about cases, trade secret cases, and the majority of them, I think, are still about people. Yes, there are hackers breaching firewalls, but the majority of trade secret cases that end up in the court are really employees, partners, customers, suppliers, former employees taking something away. So, and with so many people, you have many interfaces and companies that you collaborate with. So it's actually, the challenging is, I think, the awareness, keeping that up in a company of, in my case, of over 100,000, but also in a smaller company, you have to keep up the awareness. I think that is one of the major challenges.
Yes, Martin, I think you and I have spoken about this. Do you want to give any insights? You said you have a team of 50 people. How do you keep the awareness up?
Yeah, that's right. It is a bit difficult sometimes. It really just comes down to education and reminding people. So for example, even though every new employee has to do trade secret training when they arrive, but I also make sure that there's a yearly refresh of that as well.
Okay.
And that can also be complemented by the more security focused messages that go out from the IT security team, for example. So this will be the being reminders of, don't do a conference call in the train, for example. That's in some sense, that's a security message, but it's also related to trade secrets as well. So keep reminding people, keep educating people.
And I think, Martin, one time you and I were speaking, you said something about keep employees happy. Yes. I know that sounds obvious. Like, we should always try to make our employees happy.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, I think you know, you've got a couple of types of trade secret theft. Some of it will be malicious, mm-hmm. where somebody's really trying to steal things. And that's where if you keep the people happy or engage in your company, then that certainly helps with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things like good employee benefits and or share schemes where they feel an attachment to the company, mm-hmm. then that helps. They're less likely to do something malicious. But of course, you've also got non-malicious trade secret theft or leak, where people just say things which they didn't really mean to or weren't thinking. So really education and being good citizens certainly helps with both of those things.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So question, how to determine sometimes the difference between know-how and a trade secret? All right. So this is a big one for me because sometimes like, I mean, I have no science background, so I would just think like an Excel sheet's just like, oh, here's another Excel sheet. But how do you tell people, all right, this is a process of doing something, and this is a trade secret? Because I can tell that maybe sometimes there's a blurred line between the two, or is the blurred line not that blurry between know-how and a trade secret? Donald, do you have any insights on this?
First of all, I think it's important that you distinguish between the two. So employee know-how is knowledge inside in their head mm-hmm. that he or she has not documented.
Okay.
So if we start off by defining that as know-how. So obviously some know-how can become a trade secret, but lots of know-how is not a trade secret. So there's no secrecy component to know-how. There's no requirement to wrap know-how in layers of secrecy, whereas a trade secret has to be secret and has to be protected. In certain jurisdictions, there's a clear distinction between the two. For example, if you look at trade secret laws in Eastern Europe and Russia, the trade secret has to be documented. So if it's just inside in your head, it's not a trade secret. Other jurisdictions, it's less clear. Clearly for some companies, I know I'm aware of a number of companies who are going through a process at the moment of trying to capture employee know-how. So if employees leave or they retire, that information doesn't walk out the door. Of course, the issue about know-how as well in trade secrets is linked to things like non-compete clauses and agreements and so forth. But in my mind, I tend to distinguish between the two, and they're not the same in my opinion. But I'll let the others make some comments as well as to what they
Tillman?
Think about the two.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think you made some good points. Mm-hmm. For me, one good question that you could ask to distinguish between the two is really, what is the specific value? Because it's got to be specific. That's the main difference. I mean, the directive says it must derive value from its secrecy. What is that value? So to somebody's knowledge in their head, you cannot derive a specific value. But if you can say, you know what, this specific process steps give us a 5% higher yield, or it makes the product more pure so we can achieve 10% higher sales, then you might have a trade secret. That's specific. And that's the opposite of somebody having worked in a field and having a general knowledge and just knowing how to set up experiments and how to organize things. That is very different. And the one thing the employee can take on to the new employer, which is mm-hmm. like the general know-how in the head, but the specific of how you run a certain process under what conditions exactly, that could be a trade secret that she or she cannot take with her.
Okay. So next question I have for you guys, yes, remote working. I don't think this is going anywhere anytime soon. So Tillman and Martin, I think you're both working from home at the moment. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, Tillman, why don't I start with you? You said you have lots of employees. How are you handling this trade secret thing with everybody working from home?
Yeah, I mean, I like the flexibility personally and some mm-hmm. of the new tools that we're having, and it's less business travel. That's great. For me, it boils down what I say on the hard side, really. As a company, we now exchange so much with other external partners. With partners, customers, suppliers, even authorities, we might do audits in a virtual tour. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of really tools and hardware that we need to set up, and how do we share documents on Dropbox or we transfer. So people need to be trained and be aware of all the things that they show with these tools and so on. And the other, personally, as a employee, I mean, we connect so much more with people that I never, ever see. I don't see these people. So it's a, I think is very prone to identity theft, social engineering, social hacking. I think that's a whole growing profession out there of getting into people's heads and stealing data. So in my company, that's what you've been asking. We have a lot of training, call it internal phishing mails to train people and keep them aware. There's somebody out there that wants to steal your identity. And if you don't open the phishing mail, you get a good email. Well done, good job. You don't fall for these type of things. So we try to keep up people's awareness and train them.
Yep. And Martin, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's a similar situation. I mean, remote working certainly means that the boss and your co-workers aren't keeping a physical eye on you. But firstly, others could be, particularly if you're in a public place and remote working. Or there could be technological measures that are keeping a virtual eye on you. So things like what you've downloaded to your local machine and things like that could well be logged by IT. So there are still a set of technological means that can be employed, as well as the non-technical things such as the constant education and reminding of people. You know, it's always been necessary that people have done remote working, and even sometimes from a public place. You know, on the whole, I prefer to discourage that and only do it where it's really necessary. But people working from, you know, their home office is not the same as working in a coffee shop, for example, right? So you need to bear that in mind. But nevertheless, there's still higher risk on both of those things.
And Donna, what advice would you give to companies who now do have many employees scattered in various places?
Well, I think to add to the points that the other two made, first of all, with remote working is, remember, in some cases, the employees aren't using equipment issued by the IT department. So they're using equipment that hasn't got the same level of security as a computer or a smartphone issued by the IT department. So you've got that issue. Secondly, people are being extra helpful with their colleagues. So if Joe or Mike contacts you saying, well, I need access to this file, a lot of people are being extra helpful to their colleagues who are then also working remotely without asking the question, well, does Mike or Pete actually, do they have access? Should they have access to this file or whatever? So you see the problem that people aren't thinking about security as much because they're trying to be helpful to their colleagues who are suddenly finding, well, I can't access this file or whatever because I'm working from home today, without asking the question, well, actually, I don't think you need to have access to this. I don't think you should have access to this because this is a trade secret and we're limiting access to this. So I see problems with remote working in terms of equipment and just human nature, people trying to be extra helpful without actually asking the question, should you actually have access to this file or whatever? So, but it's here to stay. And I think that companies need to understand how they're going to ensure their appropriate levels of security regarding their trade secrets in this new way of working.
Definitely. So what do companies need to do to demonstrate trade secret theft? Now, I've covered this. I'm pretty sure different jurisdictions say different things. I know that in the UK, we have the Trade Secret Directive that says one thing. I think in the US, it's different. Donald, can I give this question to you? Do you know anything about what people have to do in different jurisdictions to prove this?
Well, in most jurisdictions, in simple terms, it's a three-step process. You've got to, first of all, prove that the information was a trade secret.
Okay.
Secondly, you've got to prove that there was theft. And thirdly, you've got to prove that there was damage to your organization as a result of the theft. You could argue that there's an initial step where you've got to, first of all, together with the defendant and the plaintiff and the courts, agree what the hell the trade secret is we're talking about. So there's sort of an identification or a reasonable particularity define that this is the information. Mm-hmm. So you could say that it's now sort of a four-step process. What is it? Is it a trade secret? Is there theft? And is there damage to the organization? It's surprising how many court cases there have been where companies can't get over the first hurdle, where they go to court and say Joe has or Mike has stolen a trade secret, and then they can prove it's actually a trade secret. You know, there have been a number of cases where companies have fallen flat on the first step because you have to be able to prove that it's a trade secret. And remember, the court case could take place years after the incident. I mean, there's one in the US that the theft took place in 2013 and the court case took place in 2019. So in 2019, you've got to prove that piece of information was a trade secret back in 2014 or 2013. I can barely remember what I did last weekend. Having to prove that something was a trade secret 4 or 5 years ago and have evidence to show it. You can't just go to court and say, trust me, Your Honor. You've got to prove it. And that's proving really difficult for lots of companies because they don't keep records of their trade secrets. It's not like a patent or a trademark where the government is holding your hand. You've got to keep your own records. And most companies don't keep any records.
So step one is companies, be sure you have something around that shows it is.
Yeah, correct.
Well, I'm just saying, if you did keep a record, wouldn't that be in and of itself really, I'd be scared to keep a record. Like, where do you keep that? Like, that would be your biggest trade secret of all trade secrets.
Well, you got to keep your records. Maybe you use metadata is what a lot of companies are now relying on. And you keep that closely controlled by your legal IP department. So they have the records if and when there's a need to produce evidence. So you don't widely distribute it, but you keep some records so that you go to court and say, these are the evidence of this information, having access controls, having protection back in 2013 to show that this was a trade secret. But the days of going to court and saying, trust me, Your Honor, they're gone, particularly with the penalties. I mean, remember, it's a criminal case in many jurisdictions. So people, as we're talking today, there are people in prison for trade secret theft. So no court is going to send somebody to jail for trade secret theft if the plaintiff can't even prove that the information was a trade secret. You've got to prove it. And that's tough.
Okay. So that's step one. Step one is proving you did your due diligence to make sure that this is a trade secret.
Yeah.
Is there, for this goes to all three of you, do you think that the laws on the books in your various jurisdictions or internationally even, are they sufficient enough to help you with trade secret theft?
Obviously, the trade secret laws have changed dramatically in a short space of time. So you've got the US Defend Trade Secrets Act, European Directive. China has a number of trade secret laws. The big one is the anti-unfair competition law, and Japan has as well. I think because they're so new, what we're going to see is in the coming years is more and more case law. I think certain jurisdictions have done a better job than others. Interestingly, Russian trade secret law is perhaps the one I think is best written. Now, whether it's enforceable is another question, but it's well written. The European Directive, I think they're going through a review at the moment, looking at certain, is there any tightening up? I think Germany, their implementation of the directive has been the best because they've actually described what reasonable protections mean. They say you need to wrap your trade secret in layers of administrative, legal, and technical protection. Other jurisdictions have just said you need to take reasonable steps without actually explaining to anybody, well, what is reasonable? So I think we'll see improvements or tightening up of the laws in various jurisdictions. But clearly, we've gone from a place of trade secret law being sort of the neglected stepchild of IP to being an interesting form of IP these days.
Okay. So still evolving. Yeah. Does anyone else want to add anything?
Well, I have to say that the longer I go without having to experience the litigation firsthand, the better, in my opinion. But I think it's also worth mentioning at this point that, you know, there is IP insurance that is available. It does exist and can cover trade secret litigation and defense. Oh. So it may be worth looking into, especially for SMEs.
IP insurance?
Yeah,
IP insurance, yeah, can cover patents, trademarks, and also trade secret litigation and defense.
Huh. Okay, that's some good advice. And Tillman, how about you? Are you finding the trade secret laws where you are sufficient enough to help you out?
I do find them sufficient. I think the laws are good enough. It's really more the slow learning curve of all stakeholders because, again, it's all secret. So nobody talks about their cases and shares what went wrong. It's painful. So people don't do that. You just see numbers, and that leads to this slow building of awareness. I think, again, if we close the loop back to the beginning, I think the best trade secret case is still the one that you're not having. So all the steps and measurements that Donald just was referring to are not only for the case later, but then the trade secret might become public already. It's best invested if it really keeps it from getting stolen in the first place.
That would be first place to start. Well, I thank you all three. Again, this has been Managing IP's Masterclass. If you have any questions or would like to reach out to any of our guests, you can shoot me an email at charlotte.kilpatrick@legalmediagroup.com. Thanks, guys, very much. I really appreciate your insights, and I'm sure our listeners did as well.
Thanks very much, Charlotte.
Thanks, Charlotte.